Hey everybody, we are back. And before we start today's episode, we have to settle the great beach pizza debate of 2025.
I can't with you in this whole pizza thing.
You are such a pretentious snob.
I am guilty as charged.
Well, I find the little like fun details like this about New England really interesting because I'm not from there. And our listeners confirm that it is indeed a thing. The internet says it started in Salisbury Beach, and I want to know.
I think you should take a trip back east and take us on a beach pizza tour.
I just might do that someday. Maybe I can meet some of our listeners.
Well, in the meantime, do we have questions from our listeners?
Yes, we do. David wants to know about Salvatore Caruana and whether he had already been made when he was meeting with Whitey and Flemmy in the early 80s.
The answer to that is definitely yes, and we don't know by whom or when. And the boys definitely had a resentment against Caruana because he had free reign and was off limits to them.
Well, because he was so high up in the ranks of the mafia and was operating internationally with the full blessing of Raymond Patriarca. You know, it just dawned on me that Raymond's surnames means the patriarch, and he was the patriarch of New England.
See, it was meant to be.
It was destiny. Okay, a couple of more questions. Kelly wants to know when we're doing the Walpole prison episode that we promised.
Okay, so let's commit to doing the Walpole episode right after New Year's when we wrap up the season because we have no excuses then.
Okay, deal. And Laura wants to know why you don't use your Boston accent. Actually, she asked why we don't say Barbosa. I'm going to wreck this. I can't speak Barbosa and Patriarca. I'm from California, so I can't even say it if I try.
Well, in all honesty, my mother was from California too, so I had that influence. The only one in my family that had a Boston accent was my aunt. And I mean, she had a really heavy Boston accent. And I went to school in Chestnut Hill. You had to keep that accent tucked away or people would look down their nose at you. And when I went to take my teaching certification, they also told us that we had to keep our regional accents in our back pocket. And remember, I don't live in the States, so I never get to speak to anyone other than you and a couple of people back home when I FaceTime or something that actually speak English. The only time you know that I'm actually from Boston, it just comes out and there's no control over it is when I'm crossing the street and someone almost hits me and the dog and I start screaming. I'm coming back home for a visit, so maybe when I'm in my natural habitat, it'll all come back to me.
Yeah, I think it's also because you're trying not to swear. So, and this format, you know, we have to like slow down our speech so it sounds good and be more like distinct about our speaking.
True. It's hard, but I'll try to let it out more often.
You are really good at mimicking, so just got to get that loosened up. Okay, so let's get started on today's episode. It is a little on the long side, so hopefully you guys stick with us and enjoy it.
The first murder victim of 1980 was 52-year-old Salvatore Sal Sperlinga on Friday, January 4th. Both he and Howie Winter had been convicted in the race-fixing case the year prior, but while Howie Winter was in the Worcester County House of Correction, Sal was free pending appeal.
Can I give a little of Sal's background before we talk about his slaying?
Go for it.
Sperlinga was born in April of 1927 in Somerville and never really left. The middle of nine kids, his parents were both from Catania in Sicily and had married there. After the first two kids, they immigrated to the U.S. and had another seven kids, all of whom stayed in the area. Like many of his contemporaries and associates, Sal started boxing in his teens, but I think only as an amateur, so no photos.
That's a bummer. It was rumored that Sal was the driver in the hit on Al the Indian Notarangeli in February of 1974. Johnny Mutterano would later claim responsibility for the hit as part of his plea agreement. He placed Sal as his driver. Stevie Flemmy had his own version of events and claimed that Howie Winter was the driver. Since four murderers weren't enough, Whitey Bulger would also be charged with Al's murder. Listen to Johnny's hit parade to hear more about Sal and Al.
Hey, it rhymes, but I feel like a broken record. How can you not remember killing someone and who your accomplices were?
I just think they were trying to get their best deal that they could and they'd cop to anything and it added to their street cred or some such madness.
Yeah, like Frankie Salemi claiming he beheaded Frank Benjamin four decades after the fact when we all know that Jimmy Flemmy did it. And that is all I'm going to say on the subject.
And that is enough. But before we move on to Sal's murder, let's talk about his actual criminal record up until the time he was charged with the pinball machine shakedown with Howie back in October of 77.
The first arrest I found was from January of 1960 when he was arrested on gambling charges along with 27 others, including Howie Winter and Bobo Petriconi, who would go on to be known as the actor Alex Rocco. You can hear more about the early days of Howie and Bobo in episode 13 of season 1, On the Waterfront. And by the way, there were also pinball machines involved in that case.
Of course there were. It would be a year before 9 of the 28, including Sal and his brother, would be found guilty after only 35 minutes of deliberation on some of the charges brought against them. Sal was fined $50 and given a suspended sentence. After that, he managed to avoid arrest and stayed out of law enforcement's radar until the Stadies began investigating him along with Howie for extorting bar owners in order to have an exclusive on the pinball machines.
Well, technically, he kept his nose clean, but the feds and the local police believed that Sal was a major figure in organized crime in the Boston area.
What was the quote about Sal and Howie? You feel naked talking to them if you're not wearing a pinky ring.
Too funny. That's hilarious, actually.
It is. And I still say it was Whitey and Stevie who funneled the info on Howie and Sal to the feds, and the feds planted the seed with the Stadies.
Hey, you're not going to get an argument from me. Joe Mack was on the lam, too. Okay, let's get back to Sperlinga's murder. So both Howie and Sal were supposed to be in Walpole, but it was deemed too dangerous for them given Howie's past specifically with Buddy McLean in the 1960s gang wars. So Sperlinga was sent to the Plymouth Forestry Camp while Howie sat in the Worcester County House of Correction where he complained that he was, quote unquote, bored.
Better bored than dead. Howie had gone to bat for Sal at the trial, saying that Sal was the sole support for his 82-year-old widowed mother.
A slight exaggeration, since as we mentioned before, Sal was in the middle of 9 kids, all of whom lived locally. Plus, his mother had passed away in June of 1979 while he was still going through the appeals process.
He had been granted work release and was employed at a print shop in Somerville. The shop was owned by the family of Somerville alderman Peter Pirro.
Peter Pirro and his brother Vincent, who was a representative at the State House, were targeted by the feds in an extensive sting operation a few years later and lost. Maybe we can find some way to weave that into a later episode because I think that's kind of interesting and important. In the meantime, Howie and Sal navigated the appeals process. Their appeals had been heard in October, and a decision was scheduled for the following month. But Sperlinga didn't live long enough to hear the results.
On that fateful day, he went to lunch at a private club near the print shop. While he was sitting there playing cards, another local, Daniel F. Moran, stormed in asking for Sal. When Sperlinga stood up, Moran tried to shoot him with a .22, but the gun jammed. Witnesses reported that Moran forced Sperlinga towards the back of the club. Sal tried to fight him off, but Moran fired several shots before fleeing the scene.
Moran was arrested that afternoon and arraigned the following day. The story goes that Sal had roughed up Moran a few days earlier because Moran was dealing angel dust in the square and Moran tracked Sal down to take his revenge. But I'm sorry, I still think Whitey and Stevie put Moran up to it if he was even the trigger man. Winter Hill had hoped that Sal, who was seen as the number two in charge of Winter Hill, would be sitting in the can with Howie. Instead, he was a thorn in their side, and more importantly, a thorn in Zip Connolly's side. Sperlinga was aligned with Jerry and Julo, and the feds were on a campaign to get Jerry and his guys off the street.
No question about that. Moran pleaded innocent the following month. The trial lasted just 2 days. Moran was found guilty of first-degree murder and assault and battery in October of 1980. He was sentenced to life in prison at Walpole with a concurrent sentence of 5 to 10 for the second charge.
In his appeal, Moran alleged that the state's key and primary witness had a criminal record. Robert D'Onofrio had been previously convicted of possession of a controlled substance and 2 other charges concerned with setting up a lottery, one of those in 1968. But Moran's appeals ran out and his original sentence was upheld in 1983.
Is Moran still alive?
Well, he was alive as of 2019, but I wasn't able to find anything after that. If he is, he'd be in his mid-80s by now. And the last thing I found was a statement that Howie made to the press in 1989 when he was wrapped up with Sal's son, Richard. Quote, Sal was my partner and my friend for many years. He got killed because he tried to keep the drugs out of Somerville. We'd kick them out of the city. He didn't keep his guard up with this one punk and he got killed over it.
The next victim in 1980 was the son of longtime rival of the Winter Hill crew from when it was run by the late Buddy McLean. Stephen R. Hughes Jr. was the son of the forever loyal McLaughlin gang enforcer Stevie Hughes and the nephew of Connie Hughes. Stevie and Connie had been killed in 1966 by Frankie Salemi. Remember, at that time, McLean was aligned with Jerry Angiulo, and Angiulo loathed the McLaughlins. To hear more about the slayings of the Hughes brothers, listen to the Hit Parade of 1966.
As for Stephen Jr., the 27-year-old was shot 5 times by 2 masked men in a drive-by at 10 p.m. on January 30th at Old Landing Way in Charlestown as he was removing groceries from his car. His pregnant wife had gone into their friend's home to collect their 6-year-old child, who was there while she and Stevie went shopping. When she returned to their car and found her husband dead, she went into premature labor. Later that night, she gave birth to a healthy baby boy. Stephen passed away 16 minutes later at the Mass General Hospital. Authorities were searching for 2 men and a black Camaro. At first, the cops thought that the black Camaro was also used in an armored truck heist in Dedham just days earlier, but they soon discounted that theory.
As we mentioned in the previous episode, there was initially some suspicion that Whitey and Stevie Fleming used a hot car from the garage at Lancaster Street for the hit. The FBI were aware of this, but seemingly did nothing to pursue the lead and left Winter Hill alone.
We have to fast forward here for a few minutes. Charlestown's Pat McGonigal and his crew were arrested in the mid-90s for a series of heists in New England, including a job in New Hampshire, where they killed a couple of Brinks guards. You'll recall that McGonigal had reportedly threatened Special Agent Nick Gianturco's life, prematurely ending Operation Lobster in 1979. One of the crew members, a man named John Burke, agreed to testify against McGonigal and the others, including his own brother, at the New Hampshire trial in 1997. The plea agreement Burke made with the feds was that they couldn't prosecute him for anything he admitted to. During the trial, Burke decided to tell all and bare his soul and confessed that he had killed Stevie Hughes Jr. 17 years earlier. He claimed that it was self-defense, quote, I had to eliminate him before he eliminated me, so I killed him, unquote.
Stevie Jr. was a bank robber and a competitor of Burke and McGonigal. Hughes had been arrested in 1973 for a bank robbery in Medford and had only been freed from Walpole in May of 1979. Another theory was that Georgie McLaughlin had taken Hughes under his wing while the 2 men were incarcerated in Walpole, and that was the reason for his slaying.
And honestly, that theory actually makes the most sense. Pat McGonigal had been pinched in March of 79 for the Operation Lobster fiasco. Georgie McLaughlin had been mentoring Hughes, and now that Junior was back on the streets and there was something of a power vacuum with the Charlestown gang, maybe Georgie saw his chance to put his protege in place. He could run things behind the scenes from prison, and it would be just like the old days. But obviously, it didn't work out that way. Instead, whatever plans Georgie had died that night at Mass General. Okay, we won't drone on more about that now, but there will be more about McGonigal and his crew in future episodes, and definitely more about Georgie McLaughlin.
Okay, moving on to February of 1980, 22-year-old Louis Cardinale was found stabbed to death in Webster Street apartment. His body was discovered by someone who lived in the building. Cardinale had a brief record that included possession of burglary tools.
Yeah, that just makes me think that he was part of that gang that included Dapper Corleto and the DeFranzos, who had been infringing on Jerry and Julio's territory and not kicking up. They all had all been killed over the prior 2 years.
It's very possible, and his slaying remains unsolved.
As seems to be the case more often than not. The following month, Alfred Marzano was executed in the backyard of his East Boston home on March 4th. Our regular listeners might recall Marzano from our episode on the Blackfriars Massacre. He had testified on behalf of Urardi. Marzano's older brother, Mario, had been a cop but was fired in 72 after an incident where he and 2 other men were arrested with pot. Mario was an associate of Girardi's co-defendant, Robert Italiano, and Mario had been killed in 77.
Okay, back to Charlestown again. A few days later, on March 8th, 16-year-old John Fitzpatrick was stabbed to death by 18-year-old Matthew McDonald of Winthrop.
Okay, I was going to skip this one and wait because it involved another one of the members of McGonagall's Charlestown bank robbing crew, and I figured we could do it when we do the backstories in that episode. However, I started digging and I learned that the victim was the nephew of Connie Hughes's wife, so a cousin of sorts to Stevie Hughes Jr. And the killer was Matthew McDonald, who, as I said earlier, would go on to join up with Pat McGonagall and the Burks. According to the prosecution, Matthew McDonald and his twin sister had gotten into a fight with John Fitzpatrick and his friend Jeffrey Hickey. McDonald ran Hickey off and Fitzgerald bolted, but the McDonald twins chased him through the streets until they caught up with him at a sandwich shop at 89 Medford Street. It was there that Matthew McDonald allegedly stabbed Fitzgerald multiple times in the chest and abdomen, killing him. McDonald pleaded guilty in November of the same year to a manslaughter charge and was sentenced to Walpole for 12 to 20 years.
I definitely think this was the place to include it, and it shows, whether intentional or just geographical, that some of the next generation got swept up in the long-standing feud. Before we move on to another Winter Hill guy, I want to take an out-of-state detour. It's a little bit out of our purview, but since we included a bit about Angelo Bruno in season one because of his connection to Ralph LaMattina, and Dad used to work for Ralph LaMattina back in the 50s, I thought we should mention it. On March 22nd, Angelo Bruno was assassinated outside of his home while he sat in the passenger seat of his car.
Taken out by his own people and sparking a long-running gang war in Philadelphia. I still have a fantasy that someday we'll do a spinoff series profiling all of the bosses.
It's on the list. Now let's get back to our list. On April 13th, Winter Hill associate Louis Lateef was killed. We talked about two men that Louis had killed himself 7 months prior, his partner James Matera and the only witness Kenneth Conrad, and we covered that in the hit parade of 1979. Louis' demise was a direct result of his decision to become an informant for the authorities and his agreement to testify against Whitey Bulger as part of a plea deal in the Matera case.
Well, let's do a brief bio on Lateef since we didn't do it during the last Hit Parade episode.
All right, let's hear it.
The Somerville native was born on December 5th, 1934. His mother had been born in Nova Scotia and still had family there, and Lateef eventually purchased a second home there where allegedly Conrad is still buried, I guess. The family later moved to the South End where Larry Zanino, aka Larry Bione, also grew up. Lateef married a Southie girl, and they stayed there with their three kids until his murder.
Despite having started his lucrative illegal gambling operation while only in his teens, he managed to stay out of the crosshairs of the authorities. But his alliance with Bulger would be his undoing. Even if Lateef didn't decide to cooperate with the authorities, he likely would have found himself a victim of Whitey's amongst the many others.
Absolutely. So Lateef had branched out into the drug business and wasn't willing to share his proceeds with Whitey, so one way or another, he would have paid the price.
While Lateef was out on bail for killing Matera, he was told to come to Triple O's to meet with Bulger. Within a matter of minutes, Lateef was shot in the back of the head and his body stuffed into a green trash bag. Bulger dragged him to the trunk of Lateef's Lincoln and moved the car to the South End of Boston, where it was discovered the following day. Within days of Lateef's murder, Boston Herald reporter Paul Corsetti began working on the theory that Bulger took out Lateef. Corsetti started questioning his Boston police sources about the possibility that Whitey was the killer, and he was floating the story that Bulger was meeting with the IRA at Triple O's to discuss an arms deal. Of course, it was leaked to Bulger, who was furious and went to Corsetti and threatened him. Bulger told him that he knew where he and his wife and kid lived and that he would blow fucking Corsetti's head off if he didn't back off. And I had to swear because that's what Whitey said in the quote, so don't chastise me for swearing, please. Corsetti was given round-the-clock police protection and began carrying a gun.
I was totally going to chastise you, just so you know.
I know you don't want us to get demonetized because I'm dropping F-bombs all over the place.
Well, Anyway, we all know that it was BPD Detective Ed Walsh who ratted to Whitey.
All right, especially considering what he allegedly did in the LaMonica murder case.
It would be just under 2 years after Corsetti's encounter with Whitey before Brian Halloran would come forward to tell the authorities the details of Lateef's murder. And we'll tell Halloran's story in the Hit Parade of 82.
Even though the authorities knew who killed Lateef, the murder remained unsolved until Kevin Weeks testified as part of his agreement and as a witness in the wrongful death suits brought against the government by the Davis and Lateef families in 2009. He told the court that just before Lateef's murder, he had spoken to Whitey about inviting Lateef to his upcoming wedding, but didn't know where to seat him because he was such a loudmouth. Whitey told Weeks not to worry about it because he probably wouldn't show. Even with Weeks' testimony, no one was ever technically charged in the murder of Lateef.
As Laura mentioned, Lateef's family filed a wrongful death suit against the government in the mid-2000s. At that trial, lawyer Kevin Curry testified that shortly before Lateef was killed, he told Zip Connolly and BPD Detective Ed Walsh that Lateef was ready to cooperate and tell all against Winter Hill. Curry said he didn't know who Connolly was at the time and assumed that he was Walsh's colleague on the police force rather than a Fed. According to Curry, Lateef also told him that he was using corrupt cops at the BPD to smuggle out confiscated drugs and turn them over to Winter Hill to sell again on the street. Ed Walsh protested Curry's retelling, insisting that he was lying, but the judge said that he believed Curry and awarded Lateef's family over $1 million for the pain and suffering they had endured at the government's hands.
And as we mentioned earlier, Ed Walsh had a role in the investigation of the next slaying we'll be discussing, and Whitey also played a role in that case, albeit not directly in the murder, but in who was ultimately charged.
Which brings us to the murder of 25-year-old Robert LaMonica on May 31st, 1980, outside of his apartment in Braintree near Faxon Park. LaMonica's father, Paul, was charged with the July 1974 murder of his business partner, Freeman Clifford, at Nantasket Beach. After shooting Clifford five times, he went to work on him with a butcher knife. If you want to hear more about that, listen to the Hit Parade of 1974.
Okay, back to the slaying of LaMonica. Just after midnight on May 31st, he arrived home from his job with the Boston Water and Sewer Department. As he exited his car on Faxon Street, LaMonica was shot twice, including a fatal one to the head. Four young men, including one named Thomas Foley, were sitting in Faxon Park drinking beer when they heard the shots ring out. Foley said that he saw the shooter run away some 180 feet from where they were sitting, with a full face view, no less.
Yeah, okay. That morning, Foley and a sketch artist came up with a composite drawing of the suspect, a curly-haired, bushy-eyebrowed, 5'9" man, about 175 pounds, with long sideburns. The following day, an informant came forward and said that Fred Weichel and Tommy Barrett killed LaMonica. It would be revealed decades later that the informant's handler was none other than Ed Walsh, and even though Walsh was not assigned to the case, he made it his business to share said intel.
Kevin Weeks would later testify that Walsh knew him, Bulger, and Stevie Flemmy. He added that toward the end of Walsh's career, he was considered to be their friend.
Well, some friend, or he really was, I guess, because he protected them for a really long time. After Walsh's tip, like magic, the .38 caliber revolver that was used to kill LaMonica was found about half a mile from the murder scene.
Yeah, magic, because Whitey told Walsh where it could be found.
Just don't think that it was Whitey, because he was protecting Barrett. And why was he protecting Tommy Barrett? Because Whitey was shacked up with Barrett's mother, Veronica.
And by the way, Barrett's namesake cousin was killed in a barroom brawl in 1973.
Yes, he was. But I couldn't confirm if Veronica was divorced by the time she hooked up with Whitey.
Well, maybe one of our listeners knows that. Okay, back to the aftermath. On June 12th, Foley, two of Monica's brothers, and two Stadies were cruising around Southie trying to spot Weichel. Foley, of course, picked Weichel out of the crowd. This was immediately after Walsh had provided a second tip.
What a bag job.
Tell me about it.
And Foley's drinking buddies never ID'd Weichel as the suspect that they had.
Well, that didn't matter. They had their fall guy thanks to Whitey's interference. Barrett would later pack up his things and head to California. Weichel was arrested in August after being warned the night before by Zip Connolly that he was going to be scooped up.
And Whitey warned Weichel on four separate occasions before the arrest to keep his mouth shut about Barrett and to take the fall. Of course, the threat that Whitey posed to his family was enough of an incentive. Weichel still maintains to this day that although he lived in Whitey's neighborhood and frequented Triple O's, he didn't actually know him until he approached him about Barrett. Before we move on, we should talk about the altercation between Barrett and LaMonica before the slaying.
You know, we're famous for getting ahead of ourselves these days.
Well, you know. On May 18th, just 15 days before LaMonica's murder, Barrett and Frank Shea got into a street brawl. Weichel, who was friends with both men, was parked across the street and decided to intervene. He walked over and told Barrett that if he didn't let Shea go, he would end up killing him. Barrett relented and let Shea go, but it wasn't over. LaMonica, who was friends with Weichel and Shea, happened upon the scene and had to stop and put his two cents in. LaMonica took sides with Shea and threatened Barrett, and this is why you don't get involved in this stuff.
I know. I always ask you, why didn't somebody step in and do something? And I know what you're going to tell me, because you either get killed or you end up going to jail for killing somebody.
Exactly.
Okay. And there was Barrett's motive in plain sight, but Walsh and his partner Derby approached the statey in charge of the investigation and told him that their informant verified that Weichel was the shooter. No written report could ever be produced regarding any interaction with an informant regarding Weichel or LaMonica's murder.
Again, we all know Whitey Bulger was the so-called informant, and everyone in Southie knew that Whitey's woman's kid, Tommy Barrett, pulled the trigger.
Well, everyone except Sprague. He testified to the grand jury regarding all of the bogus intel that he believed was real, and Weichel was indicted. The case went forward. At trial, the eyewitness Foley stated that Weichel was shorter and thinner than the man he described to the sketch artist, and that his nose and eyebrows were completely different.
Yeah, because it was a sketch of Rocco Baliro. Baliro had been transferred from Walpole to Bridgewater the previous year and received furlough permission. But he failed to return from his 12-hour furlough, and the authorities had no way of contacting him. He was supposed to be going to visit his wife, although nobody seemed to know her home address except that it was, quote, in the Brockton area, unquote. Longtime listeners will recall that Rocco Baliro was serving a life sentence for the shootout with the cops that took place in 63 that ended in the tragic death of Toby Zimmerman Wagner and her baby boy. But I am still not convinced that Rocco was the shooter in that case. Rocco Baliro had to have been one of the unluckiest people in the world. Imagine overstaying your furlough and someone gets killed while you're out on the street. I don't blame him in the least for going on the lam. He managed to stay out of prison for 5.5 months before being arrested in San Francisco, of all places.
And remember that Weichel's attorney believed that Robert was killed as an act of revenge for his father killing Crazy Clifford in 1974.
For the newbies, the reason we call him Crazy Clifford is because Laura's dad, Richie, had once told the FBI that, quote, Clifford was crazy, unquote, and fingered him for the VA hospital heist that Richie himself had been involved in.
And remember that the only person that the guard at the VA hospital identified was Richie.
Well, you know.
Classic Richie.
Anyway, Rocco Baliro had been in prison for a decade when Freeman Clifford was killed by Paul LaMonica, so I just kind of doubt that he was involved in any of it. Like I said, Rocco was just really unlucky. But it was partially due to Baliro's case that the furlough system was greatly curtailed in the state of Massachusetts.
As it should have been. The Stateys placed a tap on Barrett's phone on July 24th and left it active until August 4th. The only thing they picked up was Barrett placing multiple unanswered calls to Weichel while pleading into the open line for him to answer. During the time they were monitoring Barrett's calls, Sprague and his partner Wilson went to Barrett's house to question him. He refused to speak to them and told them that all inquiries should be made through his attorney.
Weitzel was arrested on August 13th. After he made bail, Whitey visited him again, grilling him about whether he had implicated Barrett. Weitzel told him, quote, "I haven't and I won't," unquote. And Bulger told him, "You have nothing to worry about," unquote. Some promise, anyway. It would be another year before the trial would take. Even Kevin Weeks testified at the trial, telling the court that Weitzel had first been at the Exchange on Commercial Street in Boston before heading to Triple O's, which was owned by Winter Hill associate Kevin O'Neill and his brothers. And Kevin Weeks had been working at the bar that night as usual.
Weitzel had an even better witness who never came forward, your favorite Special Agent John Zip Connolly. He too was at the Exchange that evening having a couple of pops, but he couldn't come forward because his CI, who was really more his handler rather than the other way around, forbade him from coming forward in order to keep Tommy Barrett out of the camp.
Who was handling whom?
Exactly.
Well, it makes my blood boil every time I hear it, though. In August of 81, Weitzel was found guilty of murder in the first degree and sentenced to life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. Weitzel filed a motion for a new trial based on ineffective assistance of counsel. 2 months later, the motion was denied.
2 years later, Barrett wrote a letter to Weitzel's mother confessing to LaMonica's murder. Quote, "I haven't had a good night's sleep in almost a year because I know Fred did not kill Bobby LaMonica. I did. Yes, Gloria, I killed Bobby LaMonica," end quote. His mother never came forward with the letter out of fear for her safety and her son's safety. The letter wasn't discovered until after she passed away.
Weitzel was granted a new hearing in 2002, and Patney filed an affidavit asserting that Whitey had told him that Zip Connolly could have provided an alibi for Weitzel. But Connolly refused to testify for Weitzel, allegedly because Whitey urged him not to. And that matched the story that everyone seemed to have already known. The letter from Barrett was submitted, and although handwriting experts confirmed that it was indeed Barrett's handwriting, the judge ruled it could not be construed as evidence during the hearing, and Barrett refused to testify, pleading the fifth.
In 2014, the Boston Globe reported that Bulger wrote a series of letters exonerating Weitzel, although Whitey did not confess to the murder of LaMonica himself, but rather blamed it on someone else, stopping short of naming the true killer.
In true Whitey Bulger fashion. Finally, in April of 2017, Weitzel was a free man after 36 years of being wrongfully imprisoned. The information was finally revealed about the 10 prison guards who believed that the sketch that was used at the time to ID Weitzel was indeed that of Rocco Bolero.
And I know you disagree with me, but I still think that Bolero was the shooter and not Barrett. Now, why Barrett would fess up to Weitzel's mother and why would Whitey cover for him is another story. Whitey knew damn well that innocent people went to the can because he helped send them there. So maybe he was hedging his bets by covering for him. And maybe Barrett had convinced himself by then that he had done it.
Well, we'll never know for sure, I guess, but Weitzel sued the town of Braintree. He was awarded $33 million by a jury, but there is a $1 million cap in Braintree. He tried to sue the estate of Ed Walsh as well, but the judge nixed it. Weitzel spoke about his wrongful conviction at Yale University back in May of this year.
Occasionally, there's a happy ending. We've gone way over our self-imposed time limit today, but I do want to mention that on October 24th, Richie Nine Lives Gillis was shot 6 times at the Copse Hill Cemetery in the North End and survived as usual. There will be plenty of stories about Gillis next season.
For sure. And I know that we missed more than a few people who lost their lives in 1980, but I felt like this was a good kind of summary of events that kind of move the story forward.
Right, and also tied back to things that we've already covered. And we will be back with our next episode about the Brinks robbery of 1980, stolen artwork, Dad, and Miles Connor. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Bye.
Bye.